companions. We help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Welcome everyone to this live stream, which will also be recorded as a podcast episode on Onions Talk that you can revisit. So my name is Fie. I am an interdisciplinary artist and also organized this episode on alternative sustainable development in Southeast Asia. So I called it the People and Land Story because there are enough conversations around tech and renewable energy investment, but not enough in the social care sector on how we can create more jobs with communities and for communities and also for the environment. And I wanted to just provoke this a little and open up this conversation so that we can have different narratives in this sustainability conversation. I have a very exciting and diverse panel with me today. Big thank you to all of you for taking time to do this. So I'm going to start off with a round of introduction. Juliana, will you be able to kick this off and introduce yourself and BGBG?
Thanks, Fie. Hi, everyone. Juliana here. I'm from BGBG. I've been with BGBG for the past like 8 years. We were incorporated in 2012, so I've been with them from the beginning. And BGBG basically is a social enterprise based in Malaysia that focuses very much on environmental sustainability and community development.
Z, do you want to go next?
Sure. Hi, I'm Z. I'm one of the co-founders of Langit Collective. Langit Collective, we are a social enterprise based out of Malaysia. We work primarily with indigenous communities of Sabah and Sarawak, which is on the Borneo side of Malaysia, and also on a smaller scale with some of the Orang Aslis of West Malaysia. Our primary focus is actually, we started off with economic empowerment back in 2015 when we were founded. But along the way, we have realized that the issues that we're actually tackling is a lot bigger, like with the recent happenings of the pandemic and everything, we found that we are actually working towards building a more resilient food ecosystem around the world. And actually, we would like to start that with from our own backyard. Yeah.
Last but not least, Christy. Sorry, I didn't realize I was on mute.
Yeah, I think that's like the number one phrase of the year. Either I'm on mute or you're on mute, right? Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. My name's Christy Davis. I'm based in Singapore, and I'm at the Lian Center for Social Innovation. We're a social innovation center hosted by Singapore Management University. We were established in 2006, and we are on a mission to drive social consciousness and enable partnership-driven innovation. So what does that mean? It means that we want to be a catalyst and facilitate and a power for positive social change, not only in Singapore, but in the region and beyond. So we seek to be a thought leader and a catalyst for this kind of change through thought. We offer thought leadership. We do evidence to action translational research. Which means we do research that's applied research, that the evidence-based insights can be put into the hands of practitioners who can do something with it to actually bring about change. And we have a wide variety of capacity building programs that we work with all of the sectors, public, private, and social sectors. We also have a couple of really cool platforms. One is Social Space. It's a digital social innovation magazine, socialspacemag.org, which is one way that we try to amplify impact of change makers around the region by giving voice and empowering and enabling all of these amazing socially conscious individuals like Juliana and Z right here to basically find each other, collaborate, share their stories, and learn together. So it's great to be here. Thanks, Pia.
So this episode was organized and born out of an urgency that I felt. Many countries in our region are developing extremely rapidly, yet whether or not this development is sustainable, that's a big question. So are we going to continue exploiting land, environment, and people at a very high cost to our ecosystem, or are we going to change that narrative? And what about investing in community care and community jobs? So Juliana, I know this is something that BGBG has been working on and have come up with innovative ways of tackling this to provide jobs within the community. Can you share the work that you're doing?
So one of the major main project that we are running under BGBG is called the Beyond Beans project, and this is where we sort of tackle the plastic waste issue amongst the communities, throughout the nation. We do this two-pronged, basically. Like, the main objective is to promote of course, sustainability, getting people to be more conscious about their consumption, about knowing how to recycle, how to be able to reduce plastic consumptions, especially single-use plastic. So that's on the awareness and education side that we do. But the main part of it as well is actually from the income generation, alternative income generation, actually, to these marginalized communities. How we do this is basically through these projects that we get from corporates or from the clients. We engage with these communities. We train them how to use these small-scale plastic recycling machines that we have. We provide this machine to them, either placing it in their communities or provide them access to our space to use the machines. And then we sort of hire them as the makers or producers of these recycled products, which then goes back to the public also as part of the awareness campaign. So that's one of the ways that we sort of generate income for the communities. We also empower them with the different skills that comes within the training. So there's, of course, the machine use, which is on plastic recycling. We train them about sustainability, but we also teach them about entrepreneurship, having the entrepreneurial mindset, also sort of allowing them a platform or the means to get into e-commerce, for example, if they want to. So that they don't have to be only dependent on us for any projects to come in for this plastic recycling. They can also go out there and do it on their own. So that's under the Beyond Bin site. But BGBG also, we have a sister company, which is called Mereka. And through Mereka, although we may not directly be providing alternative income to the communities, but we do empower them through education as well. We run a lot of upskilling programs. We train them how to, sort of be relevant in this whole digital transformation thing, because we believe that no one should be left behind. And especially with all these programs now, we want to make it accessible to the marginalized communities as well, the youth, the adults, even for the younger kids also. So this is the kinds of programs that we run under our sister company, Mereka.
And are these programs funded by the government?
Not so much the government. It's more on the foundations, other international agencies as well. We also go out to private corporate funders to, whenever they want to have this sort of outreach, they engage with us to run these programs.
And then in terms of sustainability of these projects, how much of an income does it provide for people in the community? Is that enough for a livelihood, or they would have to supplement it?
For Beyond Beans, I wouldn't say that it would be enough at the scale that we're doing right now, because you see, it's one whole big cycle anyway, right? We can't provide them with the income if the corporates are not buying these products. So that's where our other role is also to create this awareness, to get the corporates buy in, to get the public to be wanting this sort of change as well. So that, whenever they have the buying power, they want the recycled products, then the communities, community makers can make it. So it's one big cycle that we have to work on. I wouldn't say that it is enough, these projects that we give to the communities to sustain themselves. It is a supplement to the other jobs that they have, which we have spoken to these communities. They say it does help in giving the additional pocket money, and also sometimes it gives the stability as well, because most of the communities that we work with don't actually have a stable full-time job. It's still very much based on projects. In terms of the Mereka education side, we have actually had started tracking impact in terms of financial impact to these communities that we work with. We don't have data that is published yet, but we have sufficient info to say that they have actually sort of been able to fully sustain themselves based on whatever trainings and learnings that they have gotten through our programs.
Thank you. Another thing that I want to talk about is fruit production. So the transformative power of regeneration work, for example, regenerative restorative agriculture in Southeast Asia, is potentially a huge and sustainable alternative of achieving economic growth. And sustainable growth can provide jobs for more people while restoring and regenerating the ecosystem. Z, can you share more about your work at Langit Collective? Is it Langit or Langit?
the word is, it's a Malay word. Yeah. It's called Langit, and apparently it shares the similar roots with Philippines. It apparently means the same thing too. Langit in the Malay language means the sky, and in the Philippines it means the heaven. There's a soppy story behind why we call Langit, but I'll not get into that. But basically what we did, or how we sort of stumbled into this whole social enterprise, was not by design, but in 2013, when I actually left Singapore and came back to Malaysia, I started working with a nonprofit, going into rural villages in Sabah and Sarawak primarily to actually build infrastructure projects. And it was very specific mandate for the organization. But a few years into it, we felt that, yes, well, we were building water systems for villages that had no access to basic infrastructure or any facilities, there was always a nagging question of, where's next? And that question was always in the backs of our mind, but there wasn't really a very clear answer to it. And it sort of came a bit clearer in 2015 when we were in the highlands of Lawas. So it's basically at the confluence of Sabah, Sarawak, Kalimantan, and Brunei. So we are in the highlands about 800 meters above sea level. And when we were building the water projects for the communities there, we found that they have plenty of rice, and they have different types of rice that we have never seen, that we have never tasted, that we never knew existed basically in Malaysia. And that sort of sparked the idea, like, if they are already producing good quality stuff and in abundance, mind you, so they are mainly subsistence farmers, mainly planting for their own consumption, so much so that they can't finish it and they are feeding it to their livestock. We thought that something is really wrong here. Like, you have a really good product, you are already producing in abundance. Why is it that you're not able to gain an economic income out of that? So that was when we thought that, okay, maybe we should link it up to the larger markets, basically the urban markets of West Malaysia in Kuala Lumpur. So that's how we started. And it was also through that we found that a lot of the indigenous communities that we have been working with for the past few years, when I was in the nonprofit, they were mainly subsistence farmers, and they were actually producing enough to actually support themselves and in abundance, that, but they were still not able to sort of get into the system. I mean, to give you a rough idea of what we're talking about, like 75% of agricultural land in Malaysia is actually farmed by about 1 million smallholder farmers. And this is the official statistics, but I can bet with you that there are a lot of villages out there who are not even within that 1 million that we're talking about, the subsistence farmers, for example. But UN has also published figures saying that 65% of households that are in the poverty bracket are actually in the agriculture, fisheries, and forestry industry. So we are seeing this very disproportionate problem where people who are producing most of our food are actually the poorest in the country, at least for Malaysia's, in Malaysia's case. But when you are on the ground, like, because we spend a lot of our time in the villages, very inaccessible places where tourists will probably never be able to get to, because to get to these villages, there are basically no roads. Sometimes you have to be on a boat for 3-4 hours from the nearest town. Or, for example, the villages where we are getting our rice from, it's only connected by a dirt trail. And if you don't have a four-wheel drive, you don't have, like, amazing driving skills, you don't get there. And if you don't know anyone from there, you don't get there either. So basically, we're talking about a whole community that is sort of out of the system. It's sort of like they have lived on their own. They have been able to provide for themselves by leveraging or whatever that the environment around them is being able to provide for them, and still thrive in terms of food. And I can draw a very concrete example, especially this year, when we are in, well, I currently am in Kuala Lumpur, and when we had that sort of like a more strict lockdown, like in March, we were a bit worried about where we are going to get our food from. And there were suddenly questions about our food sufficiency, whether we have enough rice because Vietnam wasn't exporting and Thailand was having some problems exporting. And then most of our rice in Malaysia, it's imported. So we were worried for our own food. But when I contacted our farmers in the village, they were like, we're fine. Like, we have plenty of rice. We'll be able to last for 2-3 years and we'll still be able to go to the fields and plant and we'll survive indefinitely. And that sort of really struck us hard that in this climate of crisis, they're actually the most resilient. Like, if you're talking about food sufficiency and being able to continue, because we are so much entrenched into the whole larger food ecosystem that we suddenly realize it's not so resilient after all, whereas they are fine. They're absolutely fine. And over the years, I have also gone to the ground to farm with them, and their brand of agriculture, it's very shocking to me. I did not come from the agriculture background. I was an actuary. So going into the village and going into agriculture with no biases was very helpful, because we don't judge like, oh, you are too traditional, you are too low tech, you are too low yield. That's sort of like the stereotype that everybody has. Especially if you're not, especially if you're from, or even if you're not from the agriculture industry, that these little farmers, they can't produce anything. Like, they're not using machineries, they're not using fertilizers, they're not using pesticides, so they're not able to produce much. And you know, you just brush them off. But when we went down and without any biases, we realized that it's not true. And the reason why there is a lot of bias is because there's basically no data. Because when we went to the ground, the only reliable data available was actually the electoral roll. And that's it. You basically, nobody knows how many farmers are there, how large of an area they are farming on, what's the kind of yield that they're getting. Nobody knows. Nobody has an idea. And we spent two years plus, almost 3 years, in the village ourselves to collect this data. So we actually had to map out the whole area. Because prior to that, nobody has like a full-blown map of the area. They had no idea how big the paddy fields are. And since they were planting for themselves, they just knew that they had too much to consume anyway. So they're not so bothered about, you know, whether I'm getting like 1 ton per acre or 1.5 tons per acre. It doesn't matter to them. Like, I just have more than what I can consume. But it matters to us, because when we started doing that, we sort of had to know like what's the kind of like supply limit that we're talking about, because we were bringing this excess that they were not consuming out to the market. And for us as an organization, we had to know like where's the limit. And then we found out that they, without any inputs, traditional methods, without any inputs, they were actually getting the average yield of the Malaysian rice industry. But bear in mind, this average that's being calculated, it's with full input, with mechanization, and with all your fertilizers and everything thrown in. Whereas for our farmers, we are getting similar yields and it's purely organic. We don't even have to put anything into the field. So then we went back, and then as we found, we found that, oh, they actually have their own system. And this is a system that will pass down for generations. So let me draw you a more concrete example. So we, our farmers, and they actually use the buffaloes as part of their planting cycle, and we have a 6 month fallow period. So people would think that, oh, you know, like the traditional conventional view is that you have to use a buffalo to actually till your paddy fields before you actually transplant, and all these very technical terms. But then we found out they have never tilled their land, never, like for decades, because it's just too labor intensive and they don't actually need it, because their method of just letting the buffaloes roam free after they harvest actually lets the buffalo turn the soil like on their own while they were frolicking in the mud. And as they eat up the rest of the paddy, cut paddy, they defecate in that, and it actually refertilizes the soil in a very natural cycle. Like, you don't even have to have so much intervention in it. So that's where we found, okay, I think we have something here. They are already practicing regenerative agriculture. It's not some new science, new technology that came from the West. They have been practicing this for many, many, many decades and for generations, and it has served them well. But the problem comes, and we are at this juncture right now, where the Department of Agriculture or some high-tech agriculture company comes in and say, no, you have to use this, and then you start giving them inputs, then bringing them this mechanizations, and then it destroys the cycle. And you create that dependency in a very, very disempowering form. Yeah, so that's, sorry, I went a little bit too long there. But yeah, that's
no,
my
no,
take.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that, because this is a very important point. So if you allow me to share my experiences. So before I came back to Singapore end of August, I was actually kind of stuck in Canada during COVID for 6 months. So I was working volunteering in organic farms. And it's very interesting from a different point of view, from a Western perspective, right? You have all of these large scale farming, and they were mostly farming singular crops, so like wheat, for example, or cornfields, just large spreads of it. And then it completely destroys the ecosystem because there is no diversity in the crops. And the stuff that they were using, the pesticides, the fertilizers, all the chemicals that goes into the soil, it completely degrades the quality of the soil and the health of the entire ecosystem of the area. And because it's been done for so long, and you've got a massive corn industry in North America, it's almost really difficult to try and subvert that. And then they're kind of stuck in the system where you see the ecosystem and nature, it's just constantly degrading over the year. Quality of soil just goes down each year. And people are just pumping in chemicals because there are so many big companies, production companies that produces these fertilizers, these chemicals. And then and also the point of like heritage rice, right? Like these rice that traditionally grow in those areas. In Canada, when I was working in an organic farm, they actually grow heritage grains, and I didn't realize how important that was, because that kind of preserves that diversity that was traditionally in that area, and then that would contribute to actually the entire ecosystem in terms of the insects, the animals, etc. And even like tilling the soil and all these mechanical interventions, they're actually not healthy for the soil. And we don't think about all of these enough holistically. And this is something that I'm glad you brought up, because I spent quite a number of years in Europe, and then I was in North America, and there is always this predominant sort of like dominant Western narrative into how we should do things and that. But then when we look at indigenous wisdom or the ways that people have traditionally been doing things, which actually is in symbiosis with nature, and then we reflect on these current practices where you have big companies that are coming in to sell products, or you know, building on like science or technology and saying that you have to do things this way, that way, and then it builds that sort of reliance on machines that are not actually necessary. And then that's also additional energy that is needed, and we are in a climate crisis right now where energy is a huge problem, right? How are we going to feed the energy that is needed in the entire world? Like, is nuclear power the solution? Is our renewable energies enough to actually supply the energy that we need? And I don't feel like we're talking about this enough. So I'm really glad that you pointed this out. And also, one more point was that you mentioned building resilience in the food ecosystem around the world. What do you mean by that?
So I think there is a change of narrative that's very much needed, especially in agriculture. So as what you mentioned, we talk about, well, the big term is big ag, right? Big agriculture. And you realize the only singular metric that matters to big ag, it's production yield. And when you base everything on yield, it's almost like where you have the capitalistic system where profit is everything, right? So this is the analogous form for agriculture. And when you talk about just yield, you realize that actually if you really look into that, if you look into the globe as a whole, do we really have not enough food? Is it really a production problem, or is it really a distribution problem? And once you get to that point where you realize that actually we do have enough food, then we haven't even gone into the nitty-gritty of whether you are going to have enough nutrition. Just because you are eating a lot of food does not mean that you're getting the right nutrition. So this narrative is very, very damaging. And this is what I saw from our farmers, that they don't, because they are not bothered about how much they're getting, because they're getting more than enough. So well, if you ask any Asian cultures, you know, rice is a huge part of their diet. But how many of us can actually tell you what are the different types of rice are there? So like you said, you know, you have heritage grains, and then, you know, like with wheat, I mean, we're not so familiar with wheat, but there is sort of a revival in North America about wheat. You know, you have your Einkorn, you have your Red Five, and all those. But you ask any Asians about rice, and they won't be able to tell you that. They can tell you that basmati come from India, jasmine rice come from Thailand, and then pearl rice come from Japan, but that's sort of that extent. But you know, just within our village, we have more than 30 varieties of alum rice. And our farmers can tell you that this rice, I mean, for white rice, for example, we have five different types, like ranging from small grains, short grains, medium grains, to long grains. And then this is good for using to be made into like a congee. This is good for like just rice. This is good to be made into like a kueh, like a dessert. So they're connoisseurs of rice. I mean, they know everything because this is what they have. And they plant all this, like they have probably have seven plots, and they plant this in like small quantities, but that's enough for them. And then it's enough for them to give to their neighbors and to their children in town. So I think this narrative that we learn from them is that it's about the quality of food and not necessarily about the quantity of food. I mean, yes, the quantity has to be there, but it has to go beyond that. It has to go to that quality of it. And I think that is sort of what we mean by talking about the ecosystem, the food ecosystem. Like, why are we so just caught up with just about how much we are producing, but not so much as how good are we producing? I think that is the kind of more sustainable food that we should be talking about.
And also, there are statistics that say that large-scale farming, so like fruit or vegetables, fruits yield from large-scale farming actually has lesser nutrient value than stuff that's done through organic farming. And also, I wanted to talk about carbon offset, ecosystem restoration and regeneration, because actually a lot of times when you look at farming from a holistic point of view, where it really takes into consideration the environmental balance, and also that balance between what the human can contribute or intervene to help with to keeping the ecosystem balanced, there is actually so much work that is being done in terms of carbon offset, which we don't talk about enough. And when I was in Canada, I was talking to the owner at the organic farm that I was at, and they were also doing a lot of regeneration and restoration work, not just for the soil, but also through reforestation on their land, the property. And we were also kind of playing with the idea of how they should be paid for the work that they are doing in terms of carbon offset and the work in maintaining the ecosystem balance. And I think this is also something that we have to consider and think about and talk about how this could potentially provide another sort of financial avenue for jobs to potentially be created in this area. And something else that I wanted to talk about was also, so for the farmers in those areas, is there a need for them financially to purchase other stuff? I'm just thinking of if they are self-sufficient in their community, in their environment, what is the impact of that intervention from the outside world?
So two main things, actually. The first is healthcare, and the second is education. So these are two things that, you know, as much as, you know, they are still sort of geographically, well, physically isolated, you know, it's just a matter of time, you know, before they get connected to the larger system. And the work that we, well, we see that our work is very urgent in the sense that we sort of need to help them to realize, you know, how important the assets that they have right now. So, for example, the forest that surrounds the field, that surrounds the village, because they provide like water, they provide timber for their houses, and these are natural assets that is irreplaceable. So that's the kind of things that we need them to actually realize. And they would still need a financial income, mainly for, as I mentioned, healthcare. Although healthcare in Malaysia is, we sort of have like social healthcare in a sense, like you can go to the public hospital and you get treated, but to get down to the nearest hospital is 4 hours on a four-wheel drive, and you don't have any, you only have two medical officers there, and for you to get to the next big hospital is another 6 hours drive away. And if you are going to get to that major city hospital, if you don't have any income, how are you going to survive? How is the person who's going to accompany the sick going to survive? Like, you don't have anything to support you. And also your children, because there are no schools, there are no secondary schools in the village. So children have to go to the nearest town. And what about that then? You have other expenses that you incur because, you know, well, when the children are in town, you have other expenses above and beyond schooling. So those are the immediate things. And I think for us, as I earlier mentioned, it's also understanding that how are they going to see their place in the new system, in the larger system, when they're finally connected. And it can be very detrimental if you just plunk this community that's so far been, you know, physically removed into the larger system. It's very confusing, and you go astray very, very easily. And I think what you brought up earlier on, it actually has a better term for it. It's called payment for ecosystem services or payment for environmental systems, services. So that is sort of the model that we actually built our social enterprise around. So by making sure that the excess produce that they're producing can actually generate income for them, hopefully, and they are already starting to see that actually they have to protect their water systems right now. I mean, they understand that the water systems in the village provides them with drinking water. And mind you, the drinking water is much better than what we have because these are like natural streams, like probably like better than our mineral water. And for them to understand that it is a very important element for them to be able to produce the kind of quality grains that they're producing. So that's that financial incentive for them to be continuing to do what they're doing. Yeah.
So on one last point, it's on education. So we constantly sell the narrative of economic progress, right? And that, you know, this way of functioning, this capitalist system is the way to go, and that, you know, machines, technology, science, that's the way forward. And I'm just thinking of whether there are different sort of narratives in the education system, so that when these farmers send their kids to schools, they don't eventually get brainwashed by the system and what, like, you know, technology has all its grand promises. And I wonder if you're doing anything in that aspect.
Well, I think the education system, especially in Malaysia, is too much of a big issue for us to tackle. I mean, we have to choose our battles to put it. Well, you know, there's so many things that I would change, like in the Malaysian education system, if we talk to any Malaysian. But I think it's also not our place to actually dictate, you know, what the community goes through. And what we can do is to actually show them there can be a different alternative. And that's sort of what we are doing right now. Because prior to our intervention, the only narrative for the village is that send your kids to school, they can only make it if they go down to town. But then it's not entirely true, because you have this sort of like lost generation where they don't have the social capital. Not all of them can make it in town. And they don't necessarily get very good jobs. You know, sometimes they're just odd jobs that, you know, barely pays the bills. And then a few years down the road, they find that, why am I working so hard, like in town, and I don't get anything in the end? I might just as well go back to my village where, you know, I have my river, I have my forest, I can go and hunt, I have plenty to eat. I don't have to be scolded by my bosses. And so, but then they will have the problem when eventually they have a family and they couldn't provide for their kids. So what we are saying and what we are showing is that be a farmer, plant it like how your parents or how your ancestors used to plant them, produce good quality stuff that you're already eating anyway, produce them in more abundance, and then this can be a good career option for you. So we are trying very hard to show them that this is an alternative. And working with indigenous communities, and especially rural communities, it's a whole different ballgame. You don't go and tell them, this is how you should do it, and this is the big dream that you'll achieve in 5, 10 years, 20 years. The projections don't mean anything. It's they believe what they see. And the reason why a lot of projects and a lot of organizations fail in these communities is because they go in and they go out like a helicopter, and you don't stay long enough to show them that this is what it can be. And we are only just starting to see that few first early adopters and early farmers that we're working with to start to have the pride working with us, like after 5 years, when they actually come over to KL and we brought them around to see some of the places where some of the high-end restaurants that were actually using the produce. And when the chefs came out and to talk to them and actually personally thank them for producing such beautiful grains, they were shocked. And the kind of pride that came out from their eyes, that's priceless. That's priceless, because before this, they always think that, you know, what do I know? In Malay, we just said we are orang kampung, or we are just someone from the village. You know, what do I know? UCT folks are smarter. So, and they wouldn't be able to imagine that what they're producing can go right to the very top in town and being treasured that way. And that brings back the pride.
But also something to see it in terms of a different perspective and narrative is that there is no shame in being a farmer. There is so much that they're doing on the ground for the ecosystem than we ever will living in a city. And, you know, I grew up with this narrative, the story that, you know, you should work hard so that you study hard, you get a good education, you get a good job in the city so that you don't have to work so hard in a farm like your parents or grandparents have done. But what is wrong with working on farms? You know, like in North America, there is sort of like a change, especially with COVID, that people are looking into eco-villages, people are looking into going back into sort of like communities and out in spaces where there is land, where there is nature, because you see that disconnect. And there isn't that food resilience. You know, if you are living in a city, the moment that your food supply is cut, the moment that there is an import, the moment that your supermarket doesn't have stock, that's it. What do you eat? Like, there aren't even that many trees in Singapore. So that's actually a huge worry, much more than whatever water that's going to flood us potentially. So that's something that we have to think about and reshape the way that we think, you know, in terms of our relationship with work and also with nature. So on this point...
You know, just to tap on what you said, I think the irony is so ironic, right? Our villages are off-grid, and they are off-grid by not by choice. And then you have, you know, as you said, like in North America or like in some Western countries where people are opting to go off-grid, and yeah, because they think that that's the lifestyle that they want to go to. So why are we... I feel like we're coming back full circle. Right. If you look at some Europe and maybe North America, like, they have lost it, you know, they lost the forest, everything was gone, like, and now they're finding that it's so precious that they're trying to rebuild it back. Whereas we here, at least in Malaysia, we have, you know, if not the oldest, the second oldest rainforest in the world, and we are chopping them down for, you know, for quick buck, you know, because if the forest stays there, you know, it doesn't generate, it doesn't contribute to the GDP. But the moment a chainsaw goes through it and it falls and it gets exported, like, our GDP just shoots up. So, as you know, it goes back to that same narrative that we're talking about, like, what about this forest? Why is it that they're not accorded any economic value? So that is, I guess, a question that probably Christy will be able to shed some light on.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I'll chime in. I'm going to start in a totally different place than I thought I was going to start, though, just based on the conversation that's just transpired. But I think something I just want to put out there that we can chat about in a minute, because we just at Lean Center, we're just starting this new kind of campaign called hashtag Curb Your Consumption. And it's all about, you know, excess, you know, excess of consumption, but it's targeted at young people. And so then how do we, so I'm looking at both Juliana and Z, and just you both have mentioned consumption. You both have mentioned excess. You know, you're both in this amazing space where you are both very innovative in your own way. And in your own, in the space that you are working. But I'm also struck at you have very high levels of consciousness, if I can use the kind of a squishy word, around this. And so actually, I really want to ask you both, you know, what are you doing to help shift people's way of thinking and their mindsets from, I mean, like Juliana and the whole plastic thing, I read somewhere recently that like 90% of plastic is not recycled in the world. You know, and we see it in Asia, you know, just, you know, on the beaches, right? And I'm just thinking, how do you start to move? How do you not be overwhelmed by that number and what the task that you have taken up? But it's also to help people think about how they're using plastic, you know, much less how we recycle it, right? And Z, I'm thinking when you were talking about, you know, just looking at the farmers and how, what their lives are like and their well-being, how healthy they are. And I mean, in mind, body, and spirit. And, you know, I have a favorite definition of innovation, which is by an NGO called FHI 360. And they say that innovation is anything that's different from standard practice that has the potential for radical social, environmental, or economic impact. So that's innovation. Now, I'm into social innovation, but still anything different from standard practice. So what's interesting is you could argue, Z, that big ag has taken over and they're there because they're looking for, as you said, you know, it's volume, right? It's production. And that becomes standard practice. And then you go into these communities where it's the methods that they've been employing for, I don't know, generations. And somehow that is seen as innovative when it's actually the way that they've always done it. But it has become different from standard practice, you know. So what I'm struck by, and then, Pia, whether it's, you know, decarbonization or, I mean, you know, then there's education and, oh my gosh, there's all this stuff. And it's so complex. This ecosystem is so complex. And so I think Z, at the end of all this, you just said, you know what, you got to pick your battles. And so you each have identified, this is what I'm passionate about. This is where I can make a contribution. Boom, that's where I'm going to work. So I think what I'm struck by is I'm working, you know, I'm not executing, you know, I'm sitting in and, you know, hosted by a university that wonderfully has an ethos of meaningful impact. I mean, so they teach the core, you know, business and management, you know, curriculum to the students, but you know, making meaningful impact and equipping students to be able to do that is part of the ethos of the university, which is why someone like us can exist, you know, and can thrive hosted by university. So I think, okay, what do I have to offer to people like you guys who are on the ground? You've got your sleeves rolled up and you're in the communities, you're working with people and you're changing people's lives by working with them. So let me just pull everybody back up to about 10,000 feet for a moment. I do have some examples, but I'm going to shift gears. So I want everybody I don't know how many people are out there listening, but just take a breath for a minute. Cause I'm going to move into a different lane, maybe a no different highway for a moment. And then we'll come back. But what I want to talk about really briefly is just this ecosystem of social innovation and social impact in Asia. So the first is just, I want us to be, you know, encouraged actually that the current state, there's a lot happening. I've made some notes. So I'm just going to be kind of looking up and down, but let's just take the last year in particular, because it's so dramatic with COVID. We're seeing from our vantage point regionally, more collaboration and interconnected networks being built than ever before. And so it doesn't matter if you're exactly in the same technical space. What we're finding is that, you know, we have complementary strengths and resources, and that organizations are finding each other. And there's a number of collectives that are helping. So I'm thinking, I'll throw some names out there and I can share this stuff later, but Impact Collective, TBN Asia, AVPN. I mean, there's some ASEAN related networks. There are collectives, alliances, networks, both formal and informal, and their whole purpose is to increase collaboration and to be intentionally connect individuals across this social impact ecosystem. So that's one thing. And so a part of that is for, you know, investment and funding, but it's actually, you've got people solving the same problem in different parts of the region or different parts of a country. And actually, if we can hook people up, then we get a multiplier effect and economies of scale and people can work more efficiently. So that's something that we're seeing. We're definitely seeing growth in social and purpose-driven businesses. You guys have been around for a while, but we're seeing an explosion even in the last year where you'd think, oh my gosh, there's a lot of folks, you know, struggling, which we're seeing that, of course, but you've got people that see problems and what do? They come up with, this is the perfect time for social innovation to thrive. because people see problems and they want to go solve them. So we're seeing a lot of entrepreneurs and businesses, and they're being supported by exactly the organizations that we just mentioned, the collectives and the different associations and the accelerators and that kind of thing. And there's still money out there. You know, I mean, there is money out there. People, you know, impact investors or grants, philanthropists. I mean, it's still out there. It's just shifting where it's coming from and where it's going to is shifting. So there are resources. And then the other thing we're seeing is an increase of conversations in interesting dimensions. So here's a good example where I'm sitting with the three of you who are nothing like me. And maybe you're not like each other. I don't know if we even know that, except here we are for this 90 minutes. We've come together because we have something complementary that we can share. And I think all of us can take something away, and hopefully whoever's out there listening to us, hopefully everyone can take at least one new thing away. You know, that, oh my gosh, I'd never thought of that before. Or, oh my gosh, I need to meet her or talk to her. And that makes this 90 minutes, you know, worthwhile. It's speaking and panels and things like that. But what's really interesting is some of the invitations that my teammates, my colleagues and I are getting are coming from to talk about this kind of stuff: social innovation, collaboration, partnerships, multi-sector partnerships. It's coming from new places. So, for example, in the last month, I spoke at a Bank Indonesia forum. It's a big leadership forum, and they're talking about collaboration and partnership, you know, as opposed to where you're going to invest. And another was with the ASEAN. It was in their disaster management area, and they're talking about disasters and humanitarian responses, and they're talking about the power of collaborating and partnering in that space for a more effective response. So it's all over. It's not just here in you know what, plastic or agriculture. It's all over, which is really exciting. Other trends that we see is definitely mentioned earlier about just social entrepreneurship definitely picking up, and in response, you know, venture philanthropy, social impact investing, mentioned that already. We're seeing some new multi-sector partnerships and perhaps unconventional coalitions. I've seen it in the retail space, really an interesting Earthfest was a virtual Earthfest was held in September. But it was some fashion companies that were promoting, you know, swap for the earth, swapping clothes. But they also had not just traditional sustainability, but also social sustainability. So they had, a number of different folks come in, including us, talking about the sustainability of people and human beings in addition to the sustainability of the earth and the environment. So we're starting to see some interesting things happen there. And something else that one of my colleagues who's from KL, she might be listening, Tasnim, originally from KL, and she'd heard of both of you guys. Yeah, I see you guys know. She's a fan of both of you. But she was telling me about, two interesting things. She was telling me about Animal Crossing. Do you guys know this? Do you know this game? It's a virtual game, Animal Crossing, video game, social simulation, right? Okay, so I know this sounds really strange, but she said it's played a really unusual role helping people connect in both personal and strategic ways. So she was talking about this year during Ramadan, how many Muslims around the world missed out on their breaking fast with one another. And so they would go into Animal Crossing to hold their iftars or their break fast meals on their Animal Crossing islands. Okay. I have to say, I've only been in Animal Crossing once. I don't really know what she's talking about, but it's been very effective. And it's being used in a number of different ways. So that's pretty cool. I know I'm wandering off on a tangent, but I think that's allowed, right? The other thing is we just see a lot of people sharing, tapping the strengths that they have, tapping the resources they have, being really open to share and to barter, if I can use that term, you know. And I think that's where, Fia, sometimes we had talked previously about, you know, there's, how do we move from a mindset of scarcity, a scarcity mindset to one of abundance and generosity? And I think we're seeing, you know, people are frightened. People are losing their jobs. People have lost their families. They can't see around the corner. What's the future hold, especially when we're not out of the woods on this thing yet. At the same time, we've seen this groundswell of generosity of spirit. And I think, I mean, I don't know if there's a mindset of abundance, but I've definitely seen that. So I think it's really important that it's not just about the money, which I granted, I understand that's important, but we see a focus on silver linings as well. Yeah, so the needs are changing. Obviously, we're all upside down. Technology is facilitating all sorts of connecting, whether you're, you know, off grid, you know, and connecting however you connect when you're off grid, you know, to I don't know, Animal Crossing and stuff like that, you know. But I think it's important that technology, I mean, we tend to think of tech as this, you know, kind of magic, you know, silver bullet. And it's actually just a tool, you know, it's just a tool. It's just a vehicle for other solutions. I think that's really important to remember. But it's allowing us to do things like there's a company in Indonesia called Dana. You guys may, it's a fintech company. So I think it's like the third largest wallet in Indonesia. But they're out in the countryside delivering really inclusive financial service solutions, you know, especially teaching women in rural areas, you know, financial literacy. So, and just enabling them to have access, you know, to funds and financing. So that's cool. So I guess the last thing I'll mention, and then I'll also, I think, Zee, I think I probably trumped your time, but now that I have the talking stick, you can see I'm holding very tightly to it. I think it's back to something that we were just talking about, which is the need to strengthen and encourage one another. And I just love your stories, Julianne, Zee, because it's, you know, that's exactly what you're doing with the people that you're working with, whether it's your colleagues or whether it's the people that you're serving. And I think without the heart, we can't innovate, grow, and thrive. And so we need to be generative of our spirits and generative of our resources of all kinds. And that's not just, you know, we all bring value. It's just in different ways. So some of us have funds, and that's great, and bring your funds. But others of us have, you know, talent and skill and networks and friends and access to communities that someone else doesn't. And somebody just knows a guy that can help, you know? So I think that's really important to be proactive and intentional and reaching out across traditional borders and sectors to partner with people that are not like ourselves. We're seeing a lot of multi-generational work. I'm getting reverse mentored by people that are, you know, young enough to be my kids. But I'm working with people that are old enough to be my grandmother, you know? So I think it's breaking down barriers, not just laterally, but also kind of vertically in a sense, which is quite exciting. So then the last thing I'll say, and then I know I want to ask questions of you guys too. And that is, so is there a silver lining here? And I just want to quote something that one of the members of parliament, a former member of parliament here in Singapore, had mentioned. And this was in response to, we were talking about the foreign worker situation, where the pandemic hit the dormitories, the migrant worker dormitories here in Singapore. And it was really bad for a while. But there was a groundswell of response, and people started to really look at these gentlemen that are here in Singapore building Singapore, and realizing this is humanity. You know, these are people just like us with hopes and dreams and families. And she said, a silver lining is that the pandemic has caused things once invisible to be visible, which provides opportunities for all of us to reach out and care for one another. And so that's, I think, what you guys are doing with the work that you're doing in your respective domains, and that we love to talk about and share and amplify these kinds of stories so that more people can feel hopeful as opposed to, hopeful in addition to being overwhelmed perhaps by the complexity of the world and everything therein. All right, I'll take a breath.
Christy, before you move on and shoot off other questions, I have questions for you. So like you mentioned, Impact Collective and all of these impact funding spaces, and I want to ask, how is funding given? What is it that they look at? Is it based on metrics of profit, or like how do they look at things differently? Because also you mentioned there are different kinds of value, right? And I've been reading up on regenerative principles and Charles Eisenstein's works, and you know, it's also talking about how there are different kinds of value, be it in the arts, ecology, or spirituality, and there are so many diversity and plurality in it. But then yet in this financial system, all we see is financial value. And how can we expand that? How can we transition towards something different that recognizes all of these different values that's intrinsic in society? And how can funders play a role in helping to shape that transition?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's a really interesting question. And I would actually open it up to Juliana and Z as well, because you guys may have pitched and received funding yourselves. I think from my vantage point, I mean, number one, it's never going to be perfect, you know, in the sense that as long as we have, you know, capitalist systems, which I'm not saying that that's bad or wrong, but as long as you've got publicly traded companies that have shareholders to answer to, then you're going to have some degree of what you're describing. You know, it's a priority for profits. Having said that, there is no question that even in your big publicly traded companies, the move to the triple bottom line approach, to looking at ESG, to thinking of stakeholders versus shareholders, you know, I think the days of Milton Friedman, you know, the business is business mode, I think that's gone, generally speaking. I think now the friends and the colleagues that I have in multinationals in particular, there's no question that they need healthy communities in which to operate and in which to sell their products and hire their talent. So they can't afford to just have a single-minded approach to profit only, profit first. Now, I'm not naive. I mean, I hear myself, but I will say that you know, CSR, by whatever name you want to call it, sustainability, corporate responsibility, it's alive and well. And I think actually we're going to see it emphasized more through this as we come out of the pandemic rather than less. Now, how companies choose to respond to that and respond to the communities in which they're living and working and operating, that's a whole nother conversation. But I would say I'm encouraged by it. I think it's a good thing. Back on the impact investing side, actually, I mean, there's a lot of resources out there. I mean, I'm thinking AVP and Asia Venture Philanthropy Network is a great start. But just to look at what do impact investors look for? What do impact funds look for versus a straight venture capitalist, you know, or some other kind of funder? So, yeah, I mean, they're looking, they've got a longer horizon. I think they're willing to put, you know, patient capital forward. I mean, I'm not an impact investor. I have friends that are. That would be another interesting conversation all on its own. But there's a lot of free resources out there right now. And there's a lot of these kinds of webinars. There's pitch competitions. I mean, we have a group at SMU that does this. You know, so I think it's a variety of things. But actually, I would actually turn that question over, what they look for, to these guys, Julian and Z. Have you guys pitched for funds from an impact investor? And what did they ask you that seemed to be different from, I mean, aside from the fact they want to know what social impact, you know, or, you know, that angle as opposed to just what your profit margins are going to be, right?
Well, I actually just want to like reinforce what you said. You foresee that there's going to be a lot more of these sort of funds going on moving forward, right? I've actually witnessed this myself as well. Like even during this pandemic thing, there's a lot of funds that just opened up just for these sort of like social innovation sort of things to support the communities, to support people like us, like social enterprises, NGOs, to be able to have this impact that we do. So yeah, I just want to reinforce that. In terms of what do they look for, I wouldn't say that there's any like, you know, special question that jumps out. They do normally just look for, I mean, okay, you can sort of like see like which sort of funders would go for like the larger scale impact and which one really wants to sort of impact, you know, a smaller group of people, but make sure that it's a proper change to their lives, proper positive change. So it really depends on the projects also. Like we don't normally propose for projects and promise the world because we know our limitations as well. And the funders are definitely not dumb. They would know as well, like, you know, with this certain amount of money, how much impact can you actually make? So it's up to us, basically, as like the implementers or like the executors, to sort of be wise with the funds that you get, not just do everything on your own. And this is where like both your points come in, right? The power of collaboration, to work with different people who's got like different skill sets from you. Like Z said, you choose your battle. If I am tackling communities and plastic, and Z can come in with your food stuff, you know, and other people can come in with like education, for example, why not work together, pull in our resources, and just have a collective impact.
Yeah, I would like to just echo what Drew said. And I think especially at least well, the Malaysian social impact, you know, whatever you want to call it, like SIN, it's really small. So if you last long enough, you sort of get to know everyone. And everyone knows that it's not easy. So I think probably that's why we are sort of like the underdogs, right? So you tend to be a lot more open to collaboration. You know, I guess nobody is that confident enough to say that I've solved it, right? Like I have all the answers and all the solutions. So I think definitely that's the spirit that I get the sense of, well, at least in the space. And even if it's not like formal collaboration, you know, like just bouncing off ideas, or maybe just seeking some form of like social mental support, like, you know, when you go through the rough patches, you know, those are really helpful too. But there are certain, well, from personal experiences, we do have both extremes in terms of funders, like whether they are impact investors or they are, you know, just basically angel investors who wants to do some good with the money. Well, on one of the extreme is that there are people who have loose cash lying around and they just don't mind parking it anywhere. But then the onus is on us to actually make them understand that, you know, you're not going to be saying like a payback period of 3 years. You're talking about 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And if you're really in this for the money, then it's probably not for you. So it's us being able to to really vocalize that and to have the confidence to say that, you know, yes, I need the money, but if it's not a good fit, then we can't be working together, because then the whole relationship is just going to sour, I mean, from the very beginning. And I think it's a process. Mm-hmm. It's a process, right? You don't get there. I mean, if a funder is used to, you know, 12% per annum return, like, and you tell them that, no, you're not going to get that. And you're going to see 7, 8 years before you see any returns, you know. It takes a little bit of getting used to. And on the other hand, where you have funders who comes in and say, what, I'm giving you this amount of money, and you have, and how many people are just helping? Like, they're just so caught up with numbers, right? So I've been to one of these talks where they said that if you're not impacting anyone more than 3,000 people, you're insignificant. So you can't even qualify for what we call an inclusive business or something. And in that same forum, I really loved what one of my peers said. It said that it doesn't matter if you want to call yourself an inclusive business, you can call yourself a social enterprise, you call yourself an impact. It doesn't matter. Just get the work done. Just do the work. Why? And you realize that a lot of this, badges and this kind of names, you know, it's not something that we thought about it for ourselves. It's a lot of what people up there, like in the ivory towers or in the larger ecosystem, wants to brand us with, so that they know how to box us in. And when we don't fall into boxes, they get frustrated. So then what? And I guess it's not about us complaining about it, but it's just about us charting our own narrative and not get so caught up with those things, and work with people who have the same values, who can understand the value of the work that we are trying to do, or at least understand that bigger picture that we are trying to achieve.
You know, actually, just something on that. I think it's really interesting, and it's really important that we continue, however, to try and bridge the gap of language. And I'm not just talking about like an English speaker to an English speaker, or a Malay speaker to a Malay speaker, whatever you are. It's actually that inherent where you're, what's value? you know, I mean, oh, you're not even, you know, impacting 3,000 people. You are insignificant. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, is that helpful? It's not helpful. If you don't want to invest in me, fine, you know, then go on to the next guy. But it's like, how can we find ways, you know, to just be a little bit more, and I think it's changing. I definitely think it's getting better. I mean, I know impact investors and they're risk takers. Actually, I think that's probably inherent of most impact investors, you know, and they have their priorities. They want to see impact, right? And that's really, do we have the patience for that, you know? But I definitely see language issues, the lost in translation thing. And you know, so I think there's still a lot of work to be done to bridge the gap between he said, she said, you know, or they said, or whatever. And it's, you think you're trying to communicate, but you're missing it. So, yeah.
But Christy, on that point, actually, there is this thought that always bubbles up or boils up whenever these things happen. It's like, if you're serious about it, follow me and see how I do my work. And I don't even have to explain it so explicitly. Like, you can just, if you're there, you see how we work, how we talk to the farmers, and what we talk about, how you approach it. I think
so. Do you have a hard time getting investors to come out with you?
Well, you know, the thing is, we actually have to reject some investors.
Yeah.
because I think sometimes the expectations is you have to set that kind of expectation. I mean, we welcome. I mean, prior to this, like, we are so happy if anyone actually wants to come to the village with us. And one of our in fact, an international funder, we only got it because she came to the village and saw how we worked with the community.
Yeah.
And it's not just about, you know, sending in like a beautifully written grant application. Mm-hmm. It's also actually, you know, showing that you are what you have written.
Mm-hmm.
When you say that you know your community, you actually know your community, and that's very apparent. Like, if you just walk through the village, and you can't fake that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see that, you sort of won't ask what you know, in, for want of a better word, like stupid questions, things that you assume this is how it should work because the world that you have lived in has always worked like that, but. You know, like, hello, the world doesn't always have to work in that one way.
Yeah.
You know, just because you have buses or you know, MRTs running every two minutes, that doesn't mean that it's the same for the rest of the world. So how can you make that assumption? And if someone were to just go onto the ground and just come with us, you know, a lot of questions would just be answered. Like, we don't even have to try to answer them. And I think it's the same, like with Ju, I'm sure, like, if someone visits you and see what you do, and then you probably don't have such a difficult time to explain to them what you're trying to do or what you're trying to achieve, right?
Yeah, that's so true, though. I mean, like, but a lot of our funders are actually through corporate partnerships. So our clients are the corporates, and they are by far the hardest to convince. And especially getting them to come to meet the communities and all that, they would only do it for a PR stunt. So that's a different issue. But in terms of the language thing just now that you mentioned, right, like, it is our constant battle with our corporate funders to get them to understand that, you know, why they are paying a certain amount for the services that we do. They don't understand the hard work or like the artwork that comes with the production of this recycled material. For them, it's just like, oh, if I buy it off like China or something like that, it's just like 10 cents as compared to 10 ringgit to one paying you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that sort of education that we need to do with these corporates. And it's super tough because, like, you know, you speak to one person and that person may or may not get it after, like, you know, many, many sessions talking to you, and then they would have to convey to their superiors, and the superiors wouldn't get it because they're just thinking money, right? And going back to what Aziz said also, like, you can bring your funders or investors to go to visit the communities, to go down to the villages, you know, roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty as well. But then it really is like the whole starfish effect thing. You're just doing it slowly, one by one. So I guess, like, at a certain point, you kind of ask yourself, like, what else can you do to reach out further, have the same effect, but in lesser the time, you know, so that so that this change will happen faster.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? Because it's, I guess, two thoughts. Let me come back to the multiple, you know, the scale issue here in a second. But I think it's really interesting when you're describing partnering, like you're a small business. Let's just say you're a small business partnering with a multinational or corporate. So you have inherently different ways of working, and probably what you value and what you prioritize is also different. So that's one of the challenges of a partnership, where you are not a beneficiary, you are a partner, and you need to be seen that way, and vice versa. And so having those conversations at the beginning of a collaboration, which is what do we each value? You know, what's the value that we want to take away from this collaboration together, right? And what you each, you know, value is going to be probably markedly different, you know, from the other. But I think that's where, you know, setting that up from the very beginning, that it's a relationship of mutual respect, and it's equitable, meaning what you each bring to the partnership, it doesn't have to be equal, but it's equitable, that everyone has an equal voice at the table, and everyone, you know, is heard. And then everyone takes away, you know, there's net value for all. And I think those key principles of partnering and collaboration are really, really important. And it's tough when you have what on the surface seems to be a power imbalance, you know, the David and Goliath thing, the little guy, and then here's the, you know, the big, you know, corporate. But I think that's, especially in those cases, it's even more important to have those kinds of conversations. But I think, and that's where, when you talk about, you know, the starfish, you know, example, where it's, you know, how do you scale? And actually, this was something I wanted to ask both of you. And I was thinking about Z when you were talking about, you know, the food ecosystem, for example, and looking at production yield versus, you know, is there enough food to go around in the world? Actually, there is. We know that there is. It's just not obviously being produced in a way and distributed in a way that gets, you know, to all the people that are hungry and need it. But I guess there's two things. One is that issue is not going to go away. And especially with, you know, in Asia, we've tipped more than 50% living in urban centers. And that's only going to grow. That's going to increase. So we want those farmers to be able to stay and do things the way they have done these for generations. But how do we also address what's a very real issue in this complex system, where we have more than half of the population moving or already living in urban centers, right? And have no idea where rice comes from, for example. I'm exaggerating, but you know. We all know the story of, you know, the parents asking the child where the chicken comes from, and he says a supermarket, you know, that kind of thing. So, And so I don't know, how do you scale? How do you convince your partner that you have the ability as a small business to scale? And then, so then I come back to, maybe we're defining scale and multiplier effect in the wrong way. That's a traditional definition, that somehow more is better and more means you're more successful. So I would love to hear what you guys think about that.
Thanks for the question, Christy. So we prefer the word spread instead of scale. So I think what we are trying to do is that to show that there is a workable model, to show that there really is a workable model, that this has been done, and then we could replicate this into some of the other villages. We have a list of villages that we have worked with before, and it's just that we don't have the capacity to actually do the kind of work that we're doing with with one village, and now we are in three, and we don't find that we have enough capacity to build within the team to actually spread ourselves so thin. So that's why we are actually concentrating on the three products first. And we could almost find a specific product for a village. That's almost a given. But it's just about who is going to be there to actually do the work. So as you rightly pointed out, you know, technology seems to be like the answer for everything. Everything going online and then, you know, linking it up and selling it to China. That's the most successful model there is. But who's going to do that? Who is the one who is going to do that? And I mean, we have gone to some applications and some interviews, and they ask us about the same question, and what's so novel, what's so special and different about your idea, and the simple answer to that is it's not. It's about executing a very simple idea well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is really not enough recognition in that. Like, yeah. Everyone knows what should be done, and everyone is telling everyone what should be done, but who's doing it?
Mm.
And what about giving people who are actually doing something a little bit more credit?
Mm. Mm.
And so it's just back to that question, right? So if you're not impacting 3,000 people, then you're insignificant.
Yeah.
So for us, like, what we have done up in our 5-year, 10-year plan is actually to create substitutes for our roles in the village. So we don't, and we are not deluded. I mean, coming from the nonprofit kind of idea, we are not deluded into the sense that, you know, you must find someone and then build up that village to be able to go independent by themselves. It's not going to happen overnight. You know, you probably need one generation. Like, if we start, you know, with a young chap who is probably just out of school right now, and to bring that person to get the kind of exposure to really understand and what you mentioned much earlier on about consciousness, about what's the larger conversation happening around the world, that probably takes a decade.
Yeah.
And you are past that. So why are we so deluded with, you know, one grant that's going to fund for 2 years, and you're going to be able to exit from there? And that's why a lot of these projects fail, and they don't see the light of day, because they're so far in the village, and projects come and go, and they are not anywhere better after 2 decades, you know?
Yeah.
So to us, it's about really sticking to your guns, doing it well, and show them that something can be done, and then go on to the next village. Yes, we are constantly looking for people to actually replicate our roles. And if one person cannot replicate my role, then probably it's going to be split into 3 or 4. And basically the idea that the nonprofits hate is about hand-holding. But we feel that it's absolutely necessary. Because what I can do and what the villagers can do, our talents are different. So I can sit here and talk to you about this large idea about, you know, larger global food ecosystem. But our farmers are great farmers. And why is it why should they be the ones sitting here telling you all this? I mean, it's going to be great if they can do it, but maybe we should really, you know, the theory of comparative advantage, like, maybe there's a little bit more merit in, like, age-old economics, right?
Thank you, Z, for pointing that out. It's really important. I worked in the social sector back in France, and I think a lot of times people who are working in this change-making space don't realize enough that the communities they want to support, they can best support it in terms of long-term sustainability when they support them to gain the independence to actually do the work themselves, instead of always being the outsider coming in to help a community. So that was really important to point out. We're kind of running out of time. I want to end off with a question that I ask in all of my podcasts, which is that if there is one thing that one person can do to create change in this world, what would it be? Juliana, do you want to go first?
You. Izzy and I are being a sigh of relief, I'm sure.
If there's one thing a person can do to create change, right? I would always say, if there is one thing, is to just have this mindset of to just start. I mean, like, the only person who is stopping you is really yourself, and, like, you know, what better time to do it than now, when you're driven to do it, when you're really, like, you know, if you think you need to do it, if you feel like it's a calling, then just start. Don't let doubts or don't let you know, other people's questions to stop you from doing what you think is right to do.
Christy, do you want to go next?
Sure. Okay, thanks, Juliana. I had a minute to think about that very big, profound question. Actually, the first thing, I'll just go with the first thing that popped into my head, and that is to be generous, to give, just give the good things that you can give. We all possess them. And to give to others freely, to give to others abundantly, because generosity is one of those paradoxical things where the more you give, the more comes back to you. I'm convinced of it. I'm sure it's been scientifically proven somewhere. So when we look out for someone else's well-being, however that looks, then we enhance our own standing. And that just recharges our batteries and we can do it more and more. If we all did that, then we'd all be in a lot better shape, I think.
And Z?
Well, thanks, Ju and Christy. Like, I had 2 minutes to think about that. But yes, coming from a totally unbiased point of view, like definitely from the food topic that I'm so passionate about, it's very simple. Like, take an interest to know where your food really comes from. I mean, think of this challenge, you know, pick one meal and then identify the ingredients that goes into that meal, and then find out what's the percentage of the ingredients that you know where it actually comes from. And I'm not saying that this comes from Japan or this comes from Thailand and that's it, but can you trace it down to the farmer? Can you trace it down to where, how many loops it has to go through before it actually arrives on your plate? Just think about that. And if you can't identify like 90% of it, then you're actually just like the rest of the world. But if you can actually identify 30% of it, you're doing pretty well. If you can totally identify where everything comes from, you probably planted it. So if everyone can have that kind of awareness, I think a lot of our food system will just become better. It will just naturally become better because you will make a much more conscious choice in what you consume. Yeah.
This is really also about our relationship with nature and how do we reshape that relationship, that narrative, and also looking at how the ecosystem exists as a whole, and that when we think about sustainability, we have to think from a really holistic point of view that each well-being, be it or human beings or animals or nature, everything comes together and plays a part. And if any one part, any one component isn't well, then the whole ecosystem will eventually suffer. And moving forward, I think it's really important to keep that in mind. Also now with the pandemic, people are stretched in work, a lot of people depending on the field or industry, and that is going to have some sort of domino effect somewhere else. And something else that I kind of want to talk about with the remaining time that we have is that, so for Onions Talk, it's actually not just a podcast. I started it with a sort of workshops on sustainability, but really I started an international network for socially engaged practitioners end of 2017. And then since then, I've been connecting people who are working on the ground, kind of mostly started with an artistic point of view. So people working in theater, arts, and also a little in urban planning. And then when I was traveling during COVID, you know, this idea just came, like, how about doing a podcast to actually talk about all these different projects that people are doing and to connect people from there. So at any point, if in the podcast there is someone interesting that you want to connect with, just let me know. And this is an open invitation to, you know, even people out there who are listening, and I will make the necessary connections. Something that I'm also working on right now, which I think, Christy, we can work more together moving forward, is that I'm trying to connect people to build a sort of supportive ecosystem and to encourage interdisciplinary and intersectional approaches and collaboration. Because, I mean, very much in the arts, I've been researching into change making, and it feels like we are so much in the art circle or in the artistic spaces where we are, you know, just looking at arts funding or, you know, theater work or whatever. But then we can't exist in silos if we want to solve the complexities of the issues in this world. And I wonder what sparks can come out of, you know, interdisciplinary exchange where people who are working in different fields come together and really think about how is it that we can work together, how can our skills benefit each other, and how can they create new sparks or new energy synergy moving forward, and what would that look like. So something that this is actually the start of a conversation series that I'm going to plan out for over the next couple of months and probably over 2021. And there is an event at Gilman Barracks called Renew Earth Sweatshop that I'm working with Post Museum. And it's also done by a lead artist called Ron. And we are going to have a sort of conversation booth at that in the exhibition over the next, like, sort of 19 to 29 of November. So Christy, if you're free, like, do join us. And this would be sort of like a contact point, the first starting contact point in which we bring in together people who are working in the change making space to just come together, connect with each other, and build those personal relationships and see how, moving forward, how can we go from there. Because it seems like, at least in Singapore, you have all these different communities, you know, activists, people working in sort of like urban farming, and then people who are in the arts or whatever. And it just feels like there isn't that connection and those conversations that's going on intersectionally. So something that I'm trying to do is also to see how I can bring people together better. And also one thing that is really important for me is how can these conversations continue? Because I feel like, you know, even in the pandemic, there are all these conversations and it's like, okay, I'm going to go to the Zoom call and then everyone's really hyped up and we talk about a lot of stuff. And a lot of times actually we talk about things that, you know, everyone already knows, especially in the sort of Zoom setting where you are attracting people who actually understand these issues. But how can we reach people? First, how can we reach people who are indifferent or don't care or don't know enough? How can we activate, I guess, critical awareness and reflection on the situation that we are in right now? And how do we actively engage? How do we activate our community second? And how can we work together? So these are the things to sort of like keep in mind. If there is anything, any proposal that you have sort of moving forward on how things can be brought in together, do let me know. And then there may be parts that Christine and we can work together as well with what you do at SMU. And also, like, we also do have another podcast to record. So, yeah, do let me know. Yeah, and I don't know if anyone wants to share any last things. But really, I really, really appreciate the time that you're giving for this and for being present, because it's so important to be present in times like now when there's so much happening, and just holding that space for these conversations, for people to be heard. I think that's really important.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Fia. I think that was a great pulling it all back together. You're so right when you say, like, you know, whenever we have conversations like this, everyone is pumped up and things like that. But then we are kind of like really talking amongst ourselves. Like, it's our own bubble. It's the people out there outside of the bubble that we need to reach out to. And, you know, that's personally, that's what we want to do as well. Like, you know, just enlarge the bubble, get more people in this bubble, right? And if you have means for that, if you have platform for it, I'll be happy to jump on it as well. Just let me know what we can help you with.
Yeah,
I completely echo Ju, and Fia, thanks for doing this. And just something that popped into mind, like from the arts and my personal experience with doing what we are doing, it's like we lack aesthetics, and that's, I think, something that what the arts industry could actually supplement us with. So especially if we have campaigns or maybe even product development, I think definitely from the arts industry, whether be it be film, be design, that will actually be a great collaboration with the work that we're actually doing. Yeah.
So there's one question. Hello, fellow panel members. May I please ask, what are your views about the role of early childhood education in raising sustainability awareness? Thank you in advance. Anyone wants
huge.
To?
Huge role.
That's another podcast.
Well, I have something to share about this. So I was invited to give a talk on fair trade, and believe you me, it was actually to a bunch of 8-year-olds in an international school in KL. I was shocked. It was part of the curriculum that they were doing fair trade for a month. Well, obviously with an 8-year-old, like, you don't go beyond, like, you know, having like a logo, and it's only a chocolate or a coffee or bananas. And we were brought in, I mean, we don't have a fair trade we're not fair trade certified, but we actually do practice all the principles. And so the school was actually very progressive in actually inviting someone from the outside, I mean, from a local community, to come and tell a local story to the local children. And I think that's helpful enough. I mean, I talked to probably 60 kids on that one morning. And if they don't understand everything that I said, they remember that, okay, we have someone who is sort of doing fair trade in Malaysia, you know, and it's not all just about, you know, South America or Africa. So I think that little bit actually helps, and it's getting them to understand that concept from the very beginning, because we will have graduates from universities who probably don't even know what fair trade is. So I it was just a very stark difference for me that I was talking about fair trade to 8-year-olds, while you know, I have friends who are like my age and they have no idea like what Fair Trade is. But yes, but you do need to start like really, really young.
I do have a point. I'm going to make it fast. So when I was doing an international socially engaged art symposium in Finland, and it was incredible, the education that they had. So from childcare, so like nursery education, kindergarten education, they were bringing kids out into the forest and they were teaching them the impact of the sun on the ecosystem and how everything links together. And we were going in teaching kids circular economy, which was really difficult to teach. But in the end, we invented a game to actually teach them empathy of how to care for animals. You know, if you are deforesting an area, then these animals are going to lose their habitat, and you know, it all affects everything. And how do you cultivate empathy in, you know, in moving forward? But also on a side note, apart from early childhood education, by the time these kids are old enough to make a difference, it's too late. We need to re-educate people who are also older and to get them involved, because it changes always comes with discomfort, right? Like if I'm in a situation where my workplace is toxic, I know that institutionally there are a lot of issues and there are things that should be changed, but I don't want to change it because it's going to destabilize my position or put me in this uncomfortable position. I'm not going to do it. Then systemically as a whole, you see these symptoms play out, because we do need to put ourselves in uncomfortable position to create the change that we need moving forward. Juliana, what did you want to say?
Actually related to what you were going to say as well, like, I mean, interestingly enough, like recently, a few days ago, I was on the phone with a potential client who, unknowing to her, her kid actually went for one of the Mereka programs, which is more on upcycling and recycling in school. So she was telling me about how her kid was like super pumped up with like whatever lessons that was being shared in class. It was actually once a week we were going to the school teaching these kids about upcycling, about making your own things, about consumption and things like that. And so apparently this kid, long story short, has like sort of completely changed the family's lifestyle, right, and consumption habits. So the mom was telling me that she has now, like, you know, have to change whatever things in her kitchen to not have like single-use plastic, and when they go out, they cannot, like, you know, they wouldn't be getting like bags from outside and things like that. And it was really cool, and she wanted to start a movement with other parents because of this kid's experience in school. Mm-hmm. And that's why she contacted us. And I mean, it was just funny that it all came back at one full circle, but then it was like very nice to know also on our end that there is actually impact in reaching out to kids in from school itself, because they will go back and change their parents, which then sort of like, I guess, like answers your question about like changing the adults also, right?
You know, I think it's just, it's interesting. I think it's really important. I think it's really important to start young. Because I do think the kids take it home and they educate their parents and their grandparents. But I think it's also not just environmental sustainability, but social sustainability. And we're talking about consumption. But, you know, a friend of mine was saying recently, he was observing kids. He's my generation, so middle age, and was looking at, he was on campus somewhere and was looking at youth and how they were, you know, reusable straws and, you know, this kind of stuff. But then he'd watched that, he was observing that they left the room with the air con running and the lights on type of a thing, you know, and it's like, okay, so how do we help young people connect the dots that it's not just, okay, you can you know, use a recyclable straw or no straw over here, you know, but you're still buying your bubble tea over here, or you know, leaving the lights on or whatever. So I think it's really complex, but I think it's just important to just continue to chip away at it. You know, whether it's a fair trade, you know, presentation in a school, or you know, a child and a parent. I mean, I think that's so cool. And Julian, that's a good example of, there's your starfish that actually just gave birth real fast, and all of a sudden
it's
you've got a beach full of starfish, right? So,
yeah.
Okay, Z. So now it's called spread, not scale. I'm going to remember that. That's cool.
Thank you so much for all of your time. Have a really great evening.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Love meeting you. All right, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good evening.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello Onions Talk listeners, thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, it would really help if you can leave a review on iTunes or like us on Facebook. Otherwise, subscribe and share with people whom you think will enjoy this. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. Catch you next episode.